Okay. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And I'm going to set people on mute by default, but as always, people can unmute for questions and comments. We do have a lot to cover this morning, so I think what I'm going to do is take questions at specific times as opposed to in the middle, and hopefully that will help. I'm putting the link for the source sheet in the chat so that people will be able to download it if they don't already have it. Okay, there it is. I know that it won't show up for everybody. Zoom chats, for some reason, are inconsistent, but doing the best we can with the technology that we have. Hopefully people got the email. I tried sending it out in a new way, sharing the source sheet from my Google Drive, and I hope that that helps beat the simpatico boycott or whatever that thing is. I mentioned already, but there are people coming in, that I can't continue this next week. I have a special program coming up next Wednesday morning. I expect to include the flyer with the follow-up email from today. It is a learn-a-thon of classes regarding Canada. Classes are regarding Judaism and Canada, about maple syrup, about hockey, about sock culture, about politeness. So I'm going to send out the flyer with the follow-up email from today, and everyone is more than welcome to participate in that event. And then I do expect to have another mini-series for July, Clashes in Jewish Publishing. And you'll see what I mean when I send that out. I think that's going to be fun, that discussion. Okay, so last time we had talked about the community in Suriname specifically and the history of the Jewish community there. And then we shifted to talk about slavery in the Yodin Savannah, the Jewish community there in Suriname. And it was very clear that there were slaves. And that there were slaves held by Jews. Slaves seem to have been involved with Jewish practices to some extent. In other words, not only were there slaves who Jews had bought, who had been brought over from Africa, there's also some degree of slavery among the native population in Suriname, but that's much lower than the degree to which it exists among the African population who have, again, been brought there, kidnapped and brought there, really. But also they seem to have had interesting interactions with Jewish life. I gave you bullet points on the source sheet in source number one to just highlight some of this. The Jewish community had the slaves rest on Shabbat, on the Sabbath. Like the Torah says that you're supposed to have your Eved, your Amma, if there is a slave, they're supposed to rest on Shabbat, so much so that Jews petitioned the Christian authorities to allow them to work on Sunday. Because they said, you know, we're missing a day, we don't want to miss 2 days. So this was a fascinating issue, but even more fascinating is the fact that slaves worked as shochtim, as slaughterers of fowl, male slaves and female slaves, under supervision. So a Jew would stand there and watch them, they're not Jewish, watch them perform kosher slaughter of birds. Slaves were used, this is my favorite, as synagogue ushers in at least one case. In 1772, there's a record of a slave being purchased to keep quiet in the synagogue in Paramaribo. Go figure. Which tells you a few things about the history of Jewish synagogue life, right? It tells you that the problems of 2020 are not new. They existed across communities. You may be familiar with the practice of Shemira, right? The practice of Shemira is that if a person passes away, the body is not left alone. Until burial, we try to have somebody with them, and there are multiple reasons for that. One reason is practical, to protect the body. Unfortunately, there were concerns, whether concerns from other human beings or whether concerns from animals, and you needed to physically protect the body, or alternatively, because we are taught that the soul, a person's soul, is actually present with their body after they die until the burial, and so you don't want them to feel they've been abandoned. Either way, we have on record from 1774 slaves acting as guards to be with the body. We have a record of slaves who ran away from the Nasi family, which was a leading family in Suriname, continuing to observe some form of Nida practices. Nida practices, the practices associated with menstruation and going to mikveh afterwards. There were slaves who, again, when they formed their own homes, when they left, when they ran away, having homes with a mezuzah case on the doorframe. Now remember, a mezuzah has two parts, right? You have the case, and you have the parchment that's inside. Generally speaking, they did not have the parchment. They had the case, and they would put Christian texts inside, or whatever, as a charm of some kind. They had seen the Jews had it, and so they had it as well. Interestingly, we have on record slaves using the term treif to refer to forbidden foods. Treif, of course, treif. Treif is used even among Jews incorrectly, meaning the word treif technically refers to something that is torn. Refers to an animal that was mortally wounded in something other than kosher slaughter. But it's come to mean things that are not kosher in general, and apparently the slaves adopted this term as well. Perhaps the most fascinating area of the intersection of slave life with Jewish life was a congregation called Darchei Yesharim. Darchei Yesharim. Darchei Yesharim literally means paths of the righteous. And this, believe it or not, was a community center / synagogue that was founded with the help of Jews who are originally from Portugal, as well as Jews who are Ashkenazi, and it was formed for the children of slaves and their masters. So when there were children who were born from a relationship between slaves and their masters, they actually had a synagogue of their own. Why did they have a synagogue of their own? So part of the reason was because they were denied honors in the normal synagogue. The regular synagogue, they couldn't get an aliyah. They couldn't get called up to the Torah, so they're going to have their own. That's also classic Jewish practice. But another reason for it was a deterrent for the farmers against mating with their slaves, because there was an element of dishonor in this, that the slave would be at this Darchei Yesharim instead of being in the main synagogue. But again, it was more than a synagogue; it was also a community center of sorts, and that's actually how it started. It's only in 1793 that they start to hold religious services. But it tells you something of what was going on and the confused nature of Jewish religious life there, that there you have the plantation owners who are producing children with their slaves, and that the children are considering themselves Jewish. It's really kind of I'm not sure even how to feel about this. But you have to know it was a reality. So what I think we've established is, number one, there are Jews holding slaves. That's clear. And that the slaves are part of Jewish life as well. What I want to talk about for the rest of our time is the question of how Jews functioned as owners of slaves. Were Jews good to the slaves who they had? What would Judaism have expected from Jews who would own slaves? And then fundamentally, we're going to see there are contradictions between what the Torah says Jews are supposed to do and what slave masters generally did in the Americas, and we're going to have to ask, given those contradictions, how do we understand what Jews were doing. Why did Jews do this? That's where I want to go with this. And again, I would rather make this a discussion if I could. The problem is just I want to make sure to go through this in the time allotted. It's already been noted. We have a lengthy source sheet and a lot to talk about. I'm going to post the link in the chat again for the source sheets for the people who have joined in the last few minutes. So, first things first. The Torah itself and Jewish law would have expected us not to be cruel. Even if you're going to have slaves, there would be no justification for cruelty to them. The Torah reiterates four different times that Jews are to remember Gerim Hayitem, you were strangers in Egypt. Five times the Torah reiterates, you have to remember Ki Eved Hayita, that you were slaves. And in those references, the Torah says, therefore, treat the stranger well. Therefore, treat the slave well. You are prohibited from abusing them. It's very, very clear. Not only that, but the Torah provides protections for an Eved Kena'ani. Eved Kena'ani, literally Kena'anite slave, it means a non-Jew. I should note, there are two categories of Eved. Eved is the Hebrew term for a slave. There are two categories of slave in the Torah. There is the Eved Ivri and the Eved Kena'ani. Okay, Eved Ivri is the Hebrew slave, another Jew, and Eved Kena'ani is a non-Jew. They're really two different institutions, these things. Meaning, Eved Ivri, the Jewish slave institution, was a form of economic safety net. It was a financial safety net for a Jew who found himself falling on hard times. So he would sell himself as an employee for a defined period of time. He could not be held longer than 6 years. I'll answer the question in the chat shortly. They couldn't be held longer than 6 years unless he chose to extend until the Jubilee year, which occurred every 50 years. There are all sorts of rules. You have to give this Eved Ivri, the Jewish slave, the better bed in the house. You have to give him great food. You have to make sure he's comfortable. When he goes free at the end, you have to give him presents. It's an economic safety net. Eved Kena'ani, on the other hand, having a non-Jew as a slave, was viewed as also an institution in which the slave had certain protections, which we're going to talk about. It also could not be against the slave's will, as we're going to talk about. Nonetheless, the primary goal here was for the Jew who had the Eved Kena'ani, who had this slave, to be able to have his work done by somebody else so that he'd be free for spiritual pursuits. You were bringing in this person to take care of the things that you weren't going to take care of yourself. That was the concept of Eved Kena'ani. I see two questions in the chat. So first of all, Helen asks, wasn't Hagar one of the earliest slaves, or was her concubine status? So Hagar was originally indeed a slave. She's pre the giving of the Torah at Sinai. But Hagar is indeed a shifcha, she is a slave, and then Sarah tells her that she has to marry Abraham, to marry Abraham, as a full wife, meaning she doesn't seem to be a concubine. There are elements of her career that call this into question, but she seems to be a full wife for Abraham. She goes from slave directly to being his wife when Sarah has her marry Abraham. Was an Eved Ivri like an indentured servant? In many ways, yes. In many ways, yes. Okay. So, look at the protections that the Torah provides for this Eved Kena'ani, for the non-Jewish slave. Take a look at source number 3, please. I brought you from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law. This is really, it predates the Code of Jewish Law. It goes back to the Talmud itself, 2,000 years ago, and found in the Rambam and Maimonides as well. But the Code of Jewish Law is a nice compilation of it. Rabbi Yosef Karo was the principal author of the Code of Jewish Law. He lived in Tzfat. He first lived in Turkey, then he went to Tzfat in Israel. In middle of the 16th century, early to mid-16th century, he writes the original Code of Jewish Law. And he says the following, for an Eved purchased from Akum, Akum is an acronym in Hebrew. It stands for Oved Kochavim Umazalot, worshiper of the stars. It means an idolater. So if you have an Eved, again, Eved meaning a slave, purchased from an idolater, we say the following to this Eved. Do you wish to enter the ranks of Avadim, Avadim, plural of Eved? Do you wish to enter the ranks of Avadim of Israel and be among the kosher or not? What would you like? If he wishes, we inform him of the essentials of law, some of the lighter and more severe laws, their penalties and rewards, as we inform a convert. And we immerse him like a convert, and we inform him, again, of these laws when he is in the water. There is a conversion process before this person can become an Eved, before they can become a slave, and it is willing. What if he's not willing? What if he says no? If one purchased, continuing in source number 3, if one purchased an adult Eved from an Akum, from an idolater, and the Eved refuses to be circumcised, then one deals with him for 12 months. You've got 12 months to have this conversation. Beyond that, one may not maintain him uncircumcised. One must resell him to an Akum. You can't keep him. Doesn't say let him free. But you can't hold on to him as a as an Eved. That's the rule. Rabbi Moshe Isserles wrote a gloss on the Code of Jewish Law. Rabbi Isserles was a rabbi in Krakow, in Poland, and he looked at the Code of Jewish Law and said, that's all well and good for Jews who are living in North Africa, for Jews who are living in Israel. But, you know, I live in Poland. And we have some practices that are different. We've come to some different conclusions. So he writes comments on the Code of Jewish Law, which become incorporated into the Code of Jewish Law. And he notes that where he lived, in Europe, there were places where they did not circumcise the Eved, and they would in fact make an explicit condition not to do the circumcision. He doesn't explain why. I'll ask you, what would be the reason why for people living in Christian Europe, they would not have circumcised the Eved? In 16th century. So Chaim writes in the chat, danger.
Jewish, who was that word circumcised?
Sorry? What, Claudette?
The church persecuted those
yes.
that were circumcised.
Correct. The church would not have been happy. Ian, that was what you were going to say also? This was a major issue. It would have been a serious problem, and therefore they stopped circumcising them in Europe. Take a look at the last line that I quoted you in source number 3, where Rabbi Caro says, if one circumcises his Eved and immerses him as an Eved against his will, he has achieved nothing. You can't do that. You can't keep the Eved against his will. So that's a key point that you have to keep in mind in all of this. Separate from this, the Torah has a principle of what's called Kavod HaBriot. Kavod HaBriot, human dignity. And that applies to all human beings, as we're going to see invoked in a source a little bit later. So the Eved, your slave, has a right to be treated in a respectful way. Next, source number 4, source number 5, I'm going to say it outside of the text, but I wanted you to have the original there. Well, it's my translation of the original, to be fair. But in source number 4, source number 5, we learn that there is a death penalty for killing an Eved Kenani, for killing a Canaanite slave. If the master kills the slave, the master himself is subject to the death penalty. In the event that the slave is wounded by the master, source number 6, it mentions the eye or a tooth, but it's not just the eye and the tooth, it's a variety of different parts of the body. In the event that the master wounds the slave goes free. So, you have all of these protections. Now, frankly, you have surely heard about, read about, know about aspects of North American slavery. How much do you think of North American slavery actually complied with what you're seeing here regarding the slave doing it of their own volition, entering into a quasi-conversion, which only is completed after the period of being a slave, if they stop being a slave at some point. The protections for his life, the protection from being maimed. I mean, that's not what was going on in North America. It would be very hard to expect that any of this was going on. By the way, for those who want more information about this, in source number 7, I gave you a link to a class that I taught about the differences between Jewish and non-Jewish slaves in law. So if anyone wants to, they can click on that and see more about that there. But that's part of what makes it so hard to understand how the Jews we're talking about, who had rabbis, who had some knowledge of Judaism, how they could have gone in for this kind of slavery. But I'm going to go even further with it. The Torah has ample material which is anti-racist, which says, no, you're not allowed to view somebody because of their race, their skin color, as being, as being somehow inferior. We had no literature justifying enslaving people based on their skin color. And just the opposite. Take a look, please, at source number 8. Some of you some of you were possibly at a class I taught on this issue of some of you were at a class that I taught on this regarding racism. I keep getting distracted by the chat comments. I understand that people are putting things in the chat because it's better than slowing down everything, but on the other hand, I get distracted. Diane asks the question, is raping a slave permitted according to Jewish law? Absolutely 100% prohibited. Not only raping, I mean, consensual sex is also prohibited with them. All of that, but certainly rape. Now you're doubly guilty for the sex and for the violence. No, absolutely not allowed. I like the spell check autocorrect. Once the slave goes through the conversion process, is he considered an Evan Ivory? Which I assume was Evan Ivory until the autocorrect got a hold of it. But the answer is no. He's an Evan Knani. The conversion is not complete until if they're freed at some point, the conversion is completed. Okay. The interesting note there about Judah Benjamin. Judah Benjamin was fascinating in his own right. I once taught a class about him, not in Canada, but years ago. He's a very interesting figure, and yes, slave owner. So I was talking about racism. Take a look at source number 8. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. You may have heard of Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, also known as the Rav, a leading thinker in modern Orthodoxy in the 20th century. His brother, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, was also a leading figure. And he wrote an essay called Civil Rights and the Dignity of Man. He said, from the standpoint of the Torah, there can be no distinction between one human being and another on the basis of race or color. Any discrimination shown to a human being on account of the color of his or her skin constitutes loathsome barbarity. The Torah says in Genesis, in the image of God, he created man. This metaphysical idea leads to the halachic principle of kavod abrios, the dignity of man. It applies to all human beings. Then he addresses the fact that the Torah does distinguish between Jew and non-Jew. That you do find. You find certain laws that do distinguish. He says it must be conceded that the Torah recognizes the distinction between a Jew and a non-Jew. This distinction, however, is not based upon race, origin, or color, but rather upon kiddusha, the holiness endowed by having been given and having accepted the Torah. Right? If somebody is part of a covenant with God, agrees to the commandments, that confers on them a different status. But it's not about race. Anybody can become Jewish. I have known Jews of every ethnicity. Furthermore, the distinction between Jew and non-Jew does not involve any concept of inferiority, but is based primarily upon the unique and special burdens that are incumbent upon the Jews. It's not about being better than. It's about accepting certain religious responsibilities. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who some of you may know, was actually in Toronto for a period of his career, became one of the leading rabbis in the United States in the 70s and 80s before he passed away in 1986. So he also makes this point. He's talking about something that we're going to have to talk about a little bit more. So I'm going to start discussing it here. Noah, as in the famous Noah of the flood, had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Yefet. Those are his three sons. Shem is the ancestor of Jews, among others. That's why we are called Semitic, descendants of Shem. Ham has multiple sons, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. Cush being, as the families play out in the Torah, the ancestor of Ethiopia. Ethiopia becomes known as Cush. Canaan being the ancestor of the Canaanites. So those are descendants of Ham. Now, after Noah comes out of the boat, you may recall the story, in which he drinks from the product of the grape, becomes intoxicated, he's exposed in his tent, and Ham tells his brothers about it, and in reaction, Noah curses, after he is shamed as he is, he curses Canaan, the youngest son of Ham. So he says, he shall be, Canaan shall be, a slave of slaves. So take a look at Rabbi Kamenetsky's treatment of that. Number 9. Some of our enemies among the nations of the world claim that the nation of Israel is a racist nation. For the Torah says that Canaan is cursed and will be a slave of slaves to his brethren. The Torah lowered the race of Canaan to the stature of slaves. So notice, this doesn't say the Ethiopian one. This isn't Cush. This is Canaan. The Canaanites are residents of what would become Israel. Different group. But he says, the point is, you'll say, well, that's condemning a race. He says, but the truth is certainly not so. It is clear the Torah's view is against racism, as I've already proved earlier from the language of Sanhedrin 37a, passage out of the Talmud. The Talmud is talking to people who testify in court and warning them of the importance of their testimony, and it says, why was humanity created as an individual? Because we know that the other species are created male and female. So why is it that human beings are created first as just one person, as Adam? All these other species are not. Lest one say to another, my ancestor was greater than your ancestor. In order to make sure everybody recognizes we all come from the same place. We see that God specifically altered the human species from other species, creating only a single male, so that people would not come to this ugly trait. So what's the story with the racism against Canaan? But because of this apparent racism, we must explain Noah's action in degrading Canaan to the level of a slave, lowering him from the status of the rest of humanity. This seems to be an act of pure racism. But in truth, this has no relationship with racism. For racism means that one race elevates itself over another race because of its origin and lineage, as though it were formed of higher and better material and the like. The reason Noah distinguished them was because of the corrupt traits of Ham and his son Canaan, traits which he taught to his descendants after him, and so on. In other words, what Rabbi Kamenetsky is arguing is that there's a difference between an approach which condemns a race and says they are inferior, and an approach which says it's not a function of inferiority, it's not a function of biology, it's simply a function of the culture that they have chosen to create, which can change. Now, it will be worth it to have a discussion about this at greater length, because the Torah's views on race are more complicated than the couple of sources that I've brought here. There's much more to be said. There is racial stereotyping that goes on, absolutely, and I think it's worth a discussion. It's just not a discussion right now as part of this series. I've taught classes on it before. I did one at Limud earlier this year, but that's its own discussion. What I'm trying to show... Hang on, Mark. Hang on. Like I said in the beginning, we have a lot to cover, so just hold on. The point that I'm trying to bring is not to say, here's a monolithic thing of what Judaism is. The point that I'm trying to make is that in terms of, number one, the laws that governed having an eved, having a slave, and number two, in terms of the approach to people who are of a color that, in this case, Africans, people who were black, there will be no justification for the sorts of things that went on in the Americas. And I brought you source 10 and source number 11 just to show you in two more points regarding the color of one's skin. Right, Moshe Feinstein in source number 10, the leading authority in Jewish law in North America in the latter half of the 20th century. He was addressing the idea that some had that maybe people refused to embrace the Ethiopians who claimed to be Jewish on the grounds of their skin color. And he says, I was very pained to hear there are such people in Israel who refrain from drawing near the Ethiopians in spiritual matters, causing them, God forbid, to be lost from Judaism. It appears to me they do this only because their skin is black. It is obvious one must draw them close, not only because they are no worse than other Jews, and there is no legal distinction due to their blackness, and then so on. Finally, Rabbi J. David Bleich, leading authority in Jewish law in North America today, he wrote back in 1972, Judaism is colorblind. Skin pigmentation is unknown as a halachic concept. Simply so. Okay, pausing there for a moment. Mark, what was your question?
Miriam is Kusha, isn't that a euphemism for being ugly? And also earlier, I think with the Sota, if you had dark-skinned children, you're going to have white-skinned children.
Correct. So as I was saying before, Mark, the issue of racial stereotypes versus saying somebody is inferior is certainly found and something that, again, deserves a more complicated treatment. If you go to YU Torah and you search for Torchiner and racism, which normally you should not do, but if you search for it on yutorah.org, you will find a two-part class that I gave on this topic last year in which I specifically addressed the Miriam source specifically. But to say it in brief, the discussion of whether the case with Miriam is talking about Kushit as something that is unattractive doesn't affect the racism discussion. Ditto for the case with Sota. Meaning, in every culture, you will find people who will say certain appearances are more appealing, certain appearances are less appealing. And it's true that in the time of the Talmud, which is the latter source that you're talking about regarding the Sota, the Torah doesn't say anything about skin color in the Sota. What the Torah simply says is that if the woman is tried as a Sota and found innocent, she will have children. And the Talmud comments on that, and if she already had children, then she will have greater children. And their children will be scholars, and her children will be attractive, and so on. And yes, it chooses skin color as an element of attraction. There's no question that I think Jews at that time, in that place, found lighter skin to be more attractive. Like the idea, don't like the idea, I think that's fact. The Miriam story is a lot more complicated, because there, she refers to Moshe marrying an Isha Kushit, a Kushite woman, and we don't know of any Kushite wife. For Moshe, we only know about Tzipporah, who's from Midian. So the question is, what is this Cushite reference? And you have the idea in the Midrash that in his missing years, he had gone to Ethiopia, and he had married a princess from there. All sorts of discussion about what in the world that could mean. One interpretation of which is the one that you just mentioned, that it's a euphemism to say that she was unattractive, but you also find in the same commentators the opposite, that it's a statement that she was attractive specifically. So, frankly, you can go either way. Someone sent me a note asking me, did I say Noach was the first Jew? No, Noach was not the first Jew. What I said was that Shem, one of Noach's sons, is the ancestor of a number of populations, including the Jews. That's all. Okay. So what we have then is, I would think, the weight of Jewish tradition before this period being, number one, to take care of the slaves in a respectful way, and certainly not to harm them. And number two, a tradition that says that no one is inferior by dint of race. So how in the world do you end up holding slaves there? It's a very difficult idea. In fact, you find some literature that says, no, we held slaves and we were good to them. I mentioned this source last time from the historical essay on the colony of Suriname, which talked about the Maroons, the community of slaves who had run away, welcoming Jews into their home. It's in source number 12. When the Jews are on their way to pursue runaway slaves, this was 1761. But keep in mind, that essay is trying to portray Jews in the most positive light. And that's going to influence this portrayal. There's a remarkable dissonance within this essay. Because on the one hand, it exaggerated the number of slaves Jews held in order to say, look, we were really important financially. And on the other hand, they say, and we were really nice to them. It's kind of a weird thing going on there. If you take a look on your sheet at source number 13, Professor Sella Whitmire Barone in The Economic History of the Jews says, yeah, Jews engaged in the slave trade, although they never played a prominent role in it. From the early Middle Ages to the early modern period, we didn't really do much in that regard. We weren't that involved. Jonathan Schorsch, in source number 14 from the dissertation I've been quoting throughout our series, look at what he says here. He talks about how the scholars of the period waffle on Jewish slaveholding. Even scholars steeped in the archival material speak in the language of circumlocution. We do not have any source about the treatment given by Jewish colonists to their slaves, wrote Chilean historian Gunter Bohm. I don't know how Jews treated them. Earlier scholar Wilfred S. Samuel's language reveals much about the lack of solid evidence on which to base analysis, and about the ways this absence of knowledge so often became filled in by wishful thinking. What do you mean? It is to be supposed, I think the italics are added by Schorsch, it is to be supposed that the Barbados Jews were kindly masters, or whilst positive evidence is lacking, it seems probable that the Jews joined with the Quakers in humanely treating their black people, and that they ever heeded the reminder, for ye were bondsmen in the land of Egypt. He says, yeah, it's likely that Jews were good to them. We do have records of them converting to Judaism, interestingly. In source number 15, I brought you that there were slaves who actually converted to Judaism. It did exist. But frankly, I side with Schorsch in source number 16 when he says, only the most minimal expression of opposition to black slavery or trade in it by Jews before 1800 can be found. Oh, I'm sorry. I jumped to the wrong source. I wanted the end of 15 first. Look at the end of source number 15. If Jews are said to be so benign toward their slaves, on what basis? It is doubtful that the few Jewish or crypto-Jewish slave traders functioned any differently than their non-Jewish competitors, for instance. He says, just to decide based on absence of hard evidence, you don't have a smoking gun, therefore I'm going to assume that the Jews really were benign. Everybody else was being abusive for hundreds of years, and the Jews were being nice. I would love to believe that that's true. I would love to. That would make me sleep better at night. But without historical evidence, that's really hard. That's very difficult. It's just hard to sustain that argument. Again, if I had evidence, if I had diaries from slaveholders back then talking about their practices, I would feel better about that argument. It's hard to say. We certainly did not have abolitionist Jews at the time. First of all, abolitionism only starts in the U.S. in the late 18th century, and we're talking about a period that's largely before that. That's number one. But in terms of the Jews in Europe, look at what Schorsch comments in 16 about his survey of the literature in Europe. He says, only the most minimal expression of opposition to black slavery or trade in it by Jews before 1800 can be found. Despite the existence of such opposition among Quakers and various women's groups in England, you don't find a bunch of rabbis coming out against slavery. Occasionally, you do find it. In the 19th century, you find it, I should note. In 19th century America, you find rabbis on both ends of the spectrum, the Orthodox rabbinate and the Reform rabbinate, who are against slavery. But in the colonial stage, you don't find Jewish voices like that. And Jews don't seem to have freed the slaves in the colonies in real numbers. Oh, I did note, I skipped it. In number 17, there was a work by Rabbi Yaakov Avraham, the Nachlat Yaakov, writing in Krakow in the 18th century in favor of freeing slaves. He uses a Hebrew play on words. The play on words is a slave who's been freed is called mishuchrar. That's the term for being freed, mishuchrar. So he says mishuchrar is like a compound of shor and chamor. Shor is an ox, chamor is a donkey. So the Torah says you're not allowed to lead a plow by yoking an ox and a donkey together. That's an inappropriate mixing of species. And he suggests I would have said you can't free an Eved because that's like yoking together the ox and the donkey. But then he goes the other way and he says, no, I actually think it is a good thing to free slaves. He was in favor of freeing slaves. I didn't do justice to the whole wordplay that he brings here. But he was a voice who was in favor. But by and large, you don't really find it among Jews in that period. And Jews don't seem to have freed their slaves in the colonies in any real numbers. The Christians for sure didn't. The Christians did not free many slaves, and when they did, it tended to be the local population who had been enslaved that they freed, not those who had been taken over from Africa. The Christians were against it. There were Jews who freed their slaves, particularly in their wills, but most did not. So, I brought you a series of review questions here, which I want to run through quickly before we ask and answer the question of, so why did Jews hold slaves? How did Jews come to Suriname? So we've talked about that. Fleeing the Catholics, basically, was why you ended up in Suriname in particular. A ma'amad was the community council. Generally, they were a lay council. There weren't rabbis on it. They governed the community. The level of religious observance in Suriname in the 17th and 18th centuries was diverse. You had religious institutions like the synagogue, the religious school for the kids, the eruv we talked about. But many Jews were not observant, including to the point of eating pork. It's hard to give numbers on any of this, what percentage were observant or were not. We have no real way to know. Based on the Torah's guidance, what sort of treatment would we expect? I would have expected non-harmful and respectful treatment, even if holding a slave. Were Jews good to the slaves they helped? We have some historians claiming that, but nothing substantive to go on. There were no abolitionist Jews in the colonies at this stage. And did Jews free their slaves? Not in real numbers. And it helped that the church, the Christians, were against it, and the Dutch actually made it hard to free slaves. The post-1733, the Dutch colonial authorities made it very difficult to do so. Okay, so now we come to the last part. I wanted to stop here for questions. In my notes, I wrote in to stop for questions, but knowing it's 10:43, I'm going to go continue, and if we reach the end with time to spare, I will take questions, and I'll stick around for a few minutes afterwards as well. But I want to make sure that we get this final section in. So, why did Jews hold slaves to this extent? Where were the rabbis who we talked about, Rabbi Pardo, Rabbi Abuab? Where were they on this? So again, you could argue that the Jews were nice, but again, it seems unlikely and we don't have historical evidence to support it. So in order to answer this question, we first go back to the basic question of why anybody held slaves. And we know the answer to that. They wanted to sustain the farms which would produce in order to be able to trade and to do well economically. That's why they were there in the first place. That's one piece of it. The other piece of it was European perception of Africans. Take a look at source number 18. From the Encyclopedia Britannica of 1792, and I apologize because this is awful, but you need to know what was printed in what would have been considered an authoritative text. Vices the most notorious seem to be the portion of this unhappy race. I half expected to say Jews, but it's talking about West Africans. idleness, treachery, revenge, cruelty, impudence, stealing, lying, profanity, debauchery, nastiness, and intemperance, all said to have extinguished the principles of natural law and to have silenced the reproofs of conscience. I mean, really, that's the way Luther talked about the Jews. It's the same thing. But this is awful. Like, that's the background against which Europeans are coming to this. And the church supported it with reference to something we talked about earlier, the Hamitic myth. The Hamitic myth, Hamitic, H-A-M-I-T-I-C, is the idea that Ham was cursed, and therefore the Africans have to be enslaved. Take a look at source number 19. We referred to this verse before when I talked about Rabbi Kamenetsky. And he said, Noach said, cursed is Canaan, a slave of slaves he shall be to his brethren. So the church looked at that and said, aha, see that? That justifies slavery. Of course it doesn't, because they picked the wrong son of Ham. It's Cush, not Canaan. Canaan is the ancestor of the Canaanites, the ones who the Jews meet when they come back into Israel, when they get out of Egypt. But that was used so much so that there were Christian writers who blamed the Jews for this myth. Take a look at source number 20 from Shorsh. Some black and black Christian scholars had laid the blame for this curse of Ham at the feet of Jewish biblical interpretations. But the notion of a curse on Ham played very little role in Jewish discourse during this era. Certainly only with great rarity was it connected to blacks. The overwhelming majority of exegetes from the 15th through the 17th centuries made no comment whatsoever on Noah's cursing of Ham or Canaan when glossing the Parsha, the portion in which it appeared. No one was making that comment among Jews. This wasn't one of ours. That doesn't stop us from being blamed for it, but this wasn't from us. So when you look at the non-Jewish slaveholding population, they're motivated by two things. Number one, financial gain. And number two, the sense that the population they're talking about is inferior in the ways described by the Encyclopedia Britannica. Right? Science says so. And religiously, by this idea that the church is promoting at that stage. So what about the Jews? Four factors. Number one, everyone was doing it. Everyone was doing it, so Jews did it too. Right? I brought you a brief quote from Isaac de Pinto, a Jewish philosopher in Amsterdam in the 18th century. The Jew is a chameleon, everywhere taking on the colors of its surroundings. I should say taking. That's something that we've certainly seen before. The idea that Jews act in the worst ways of society at times. Professor Robert Cohen of the University of Haifa makes this point as well. Jews were acting as part of society, and I think that is part of what's going on here. Not the whole thing, but definitely part of what's happening here. Number two, Jews saw holding slaves as a way to mark social standing. We already noted that the historical essay on the colony of Suriname exaggerated the Jewish slaveholdings as a way to say, look how powerful we were within the community. It was a way to say, look, we are really strong. Take a look at source number 22. Shorsh writes, I have tried to show that Jewish slaveholding in the Americas bore few Jewish particularities. It wasn't like it was something that was Jewish per se. Indeed, it comes across as identical phenomenologically in so many ways to slaveholding among surrounding non-Jews. While one might have expected Jews to have always behaved like Jews, an assumption that depends on the positing of a constant homogeneous Jewish tradition or practice, the early modern history of Jewish slaveholding shows that the surrounding culture of slave owning proved itself far more influential than any Jewish tradition. So Jews are doing it because society is, and they're doing it because it will give them standing. When you are holding somebody else as inferior, that gives you the feeling and the recognition in society that you are superior. Think of the following. The plague of the firstborn in Egypt. We're told that it applies from the Bechor of Paro, the firstborn of Pharaoh, ad Bechor HaShivcha, to the firstborn of the maids in Egypt. Rashi there quotes a midrash that even the slaves enslaved Jews in Egypt. So this, what you're seeing here, is a flipping of that. The Jews who are held as inferior by their Christian neighbors identify a slave class that they will hold, and that will give the Jews greater status. So that's another reason why. To be like the neighbors, and to be, you know, to feel like you have standing. And then third, this is something that Schorsch already hinted at with his comment about the, you know, you're assuming there was a homogeneous Jewish tradition. The truth of the matter is that people in the colonies, like Jews, to be honest, in other places, ignored Jewish law when Jewish law was inconvenient. Surprise! The Jewish law itself provides views that may ignore the laws that we've defined for slaves already. Take a look at source number 23. Schorsch writes, having never seen a text which discusses the halachot, the laws of slaves in the Americas, I can only assume that the Sephardic lay people and rabbis, insofar as they consider the issue at all, chose to follow those rabbinic opinions that obviated the Jewish slave owner from the necessity of following slave-related halakha. They said, you know what? Like so many things in Judaism, this is a debate. So I follow the views that are more lenient in what I can do. We did see them follow certain rules for slaves, like having them rest on Shabbat. But when it came to Jewish law as a whole, and Jewish law which was inconvenient, they said, you know what? We're not interested. Take a look at source number 24, please. Halachic slave law, in its maximal inclusive version, meaning Jewish law for slaves, which is going to be the most expansive, which is going to apply rules and rituals in the broadest way, probably appeared positively medieval in its ceremonial aspects to Jews desperate to prove their modernity. And it posed huge inconveniences to the cold calculations seemingly necessary for the profitable use of slaves. Jewish law was inconvenient. So therefore, even if you had a tradition that said, treat them well, those who said, yeah, I can't treat them well and make money, said either, there are other views I can go with, or this is antiquated. This is too hard for me. I'm getting rid of this one. And as far as the rabbis, we already noted, they were not in strong positions. They're not serving on the ma'amad. Right? They're not on the council. The town council is lay-led. They're not in a position of power in these colonies. Often, they're there temporarily, and then they're going home to Europe. So they're not in a position that they're going to be able to actually enforce anything on the population. And then the last factor is the Eved Kenani institution in Europe, the institution of being able to hold a non-Jewish slave, actually provided some justification for them. If you take a look at source number 25, Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra was a leading Jewish authority going back to the 16th century. You see that I wrote there on the sheet. He was born in Spain. He was a rabbi in Israel. He was a rabbi in Cairo. So he wrote the following. A slave who is not circumcised and does not immerse and worships idolatry, right? Remember we said in the beginning of the class today, he's supposed to agree to convert. And if he doesn't agree to convert, you can't hold him. May not be maintained in Israel, even for one day. But outside of Israel, one may maintain him. Outside of Israel, you are able to maintain such a slave. So they looked at that and said, see that? That's a basis. That's something which we can use in order to justify what we're doing. So that, From a standpoint of Jewish tradition and Jewish law, no. The slavery that was practiced in these colonies, the slavery which became dominant in the Americas, is absolutely anathema. Can't do it. Maybe Jews didn't do it. Maybe individual Jews didn't do it. But we don't have good grounding, good evidence to support the idea that Jews were different from the other slaveholders. Why? First of all, same reasons as their non-Jewish neighbors. They're doing it for economics. They're doing it because society has declared the African population to be inferior. Everybody else is doing it. Holding slaves is a way to mark social standing. People ignored Jewish law when Jewish law was inconvenient and the rabbis did not have the authority to be able to enforce it. And they looked at the institution of Eved Kenani, the non-Jewish slave, and said, see, we can use that as a basis for holding slaves here. There's more to be said, obviously, but that's what I could fit into 4 hours. I will note that things changed over time after this. I already mentioned that when you get into the 19th century, you find that there are rabbis, not all rabbis in the U.S., but you find rabbis who are indeed abolitionists, who are against slaveholding. That continues during the American Civil War, where there were rabbis who were very vocal in this regard. And it continues into the 20th century in the Civil Rights Movement, so that you had Jews, quite a few, who were very involved in the Civil Rights Movement. I taught classes on this before I got to Toronto. Maybe at some point we'll revisit the topic and talk about that. Obviously, the image of Rabbi Avram Joshua Heschel in the march in Selma is a key moment and one that's very visible. But much more than that, many of the freedom riders, the people who were involved in the campaigns to register to vote and so on, those were... there were Jews who were heavily involved at that point, to the point where it earned animosity from the non-Jewish community saying, hey, why are these Jews so active, these liberal Jews? So there's a lot to be said about that as well. So I really enjoyed this series. There's so much to talk about. There are more comments here in the chat, some sent to me and some to others. Someone asked if the next series will be on Wednesday mornings at 10. The answer is yes, God willing. Yeah, definitely pondering how being a slaveholder affects the slaveholder, for sure, is something important, as Anne just noted. I thank you all. I'm going to send out a follow-up email, God willing, in which I will note the session next week. There's a special program for Canada Day and the July series that I'm planning on offering on clashes in Jewish publishing over time. But I'll stick around for a few minutes now for questions and comments. So let's have a conversation. Thank you so much for participating. Thank you, Eddie.
Can I ask you, please?
Yeah.
With the early the patriarchs, for instance, from the Middle East and from North Africa, wouldn't they have been dark skinned?
So this is always an interesting question. I just read something last night about the Black Lives Matter movement calling for the destruction of statues and stained glass windows, which portray Jesus as white. So my understanding is they would not have been black, meaning they're living in North Africa. They're not living in the Middle or South. They would have been Middle Eastern. That's what they would have looked like.
Right, but not darker skin than North Americans. They
yes.
would have looked like Middle Easterns that come, Middle Eastern people who come here. I mean, they, if you want to talk skin color, they tend to be darker than we are. But it's just a fact of their geography.
Right. So I would say a few things. Number one, when you talk about we and North America, you have to be very careful. Because what I think you may mean is Europeans who came over to North America. The native population, the indigenous population, looks very different. But in terms of what you're, of the specifics of what you're asking, they would have been darker, yes. Not that dark. We actually have good basis for knowing this. There's a body of law in Judaism surrounding something called sarat. Sarat is usually mistranslated as leprosy. It is not leprosy. But it was some kind of spiritual illness that was manifest on the skin. And the Mishnah, which goes back a couple of thousand years, gives ways to identify marks of sarat on skin, and it identifies them as being darker and being lighter and contrasting with different colors. And it seems clear their skin was darker than what you will see, you know, in somebody from, you know, Northern Europe, but not they're not black skinned, not by any stretch of the imagination. Sure. I'm just looking at the notes that we had in the chat here. Someone asked me what the story was with Coca-Cola. We never got to that. There was a rabbi in Atlanta. Fascinating story about what he did to certify Coca-Cola in the early days, and his career is a very interesting one. This is in the beginning of the 20th century. We just have to come back to it at some point. I'm not going to be able to get to it right now. Someone asked me in a private message, would I consider giving a class on Jewish law and COVID-19? So I gave a lot of them, actually, starting on Passover and then continuing afterwards. If you go to yutara.org and you search for Torchiner and pandemic, you'll see I did a lot on the medical ethics and social ethics issues. A little bit online on YouTube also. So you might want to look there. I actually had, as you may recall, I sent out an email asking about this series, whether we should do something from history, whether we should do something from biblical text, or we should do something on the pandemic. And the majority of people were tired of hearing about the pandemic. They wanted a topic that was different. They weren't looking for that. But there is, like, I have, you know, some stuff online, and, you know, quite a bit about it. Probably, you know, do some kind of, God willing, a retrospective after the pandemic is over. We'll see. Okay, well, thank you so much. Thank you for all the nice comments in the chat as well. This has been fun. All right, thank you very much.